Welcome to the Grappling Discourse podcast. I've got Lonnie Jones here. Lonnie has been a great mentor and friend over the years to me. I'm really excited to have you on today. First, I want to start off by just asking about how you got into counseling.
Okay, so I went to college and was trained as a minister. I was a youth minister for 2 years, and then I went to college to get actually formally trained. And so I have an undergraduate degree in Bible. And when I took my first job as a minister, not a youth minister, but a minister, I realized that I had not been trained to minister. I could preach and teach, but I didn't know how to deal with people in crisis. I was in Salem, Arkansas, a town of 1,700 people. There had been a church there that had a division. There were two churches, and while I was there, those two churches reconciled that division after 25 years and became one church. So I inherited all these people I didn't know. And there was a lady there who was a widow, and she was in complicated grieving. And she'd been a widow longer than I'd been alive. I was 20 years old, maybe 21. And she was grieving this husband that had died. And I was unprepared to deal with that. And so I started looking into what it takes to deal with grief and trying to understand the science behind it. And then we moved to Huntsville. And I came from a town of 1,700 people and a little bitty church, and I would visit every bed in the hospital on Tuesdays and every bed in the nursing home on Thursdays, to having 12 high schools represented in my youth group, and urban kids, and the complicated blended family issues, and girls that cut, and anorexia. And so I asked the guys that I worked for, said, instead of going to youth ministers conferences, could I take that time and study counseling at a local university? And that turned into a master's degree in counseling psychology. And then in Alabama, you've got to have a supervisor to get a license. And it's 3,000 hours of supervision under a guy. You work under his license. And a young man I was rock climbing with, a kid named Steve Culpepper, his dad was actually a school psychologist and said, "Hey, I'd like to help Lonnie with that." And so Howard Culpepper basically tutored me, and I worked under him. I think it took me 5 years because I was on the part-time plan, and I ended up with a license as a counselor to go along with my master's degree, and decided about 5 years after getting that license that I'd like to be self-supported in my ministry, and that I wasn't going to ask the church to be responsible for my income, that I'd generate that income and then do ministry as a bivocational minister or self-supported minister.
And so you start off, as you said, you're a preacher, you're in Arkansas, 1,700 people. End up getting, after 5 years, your counseling license. What did you learn? Like, what were the big things that you learned about mental health over those 5 years? Like, how did your perception change from, again, being that kid in Arkansas trying to deal with a grieving widow to 5 years later, you've got your counseling degree?
Well, mental illness, quote unquote, mental illness is not some mysterious thing. What I do is cognitive behavioral therapy or solution-oriented brief therapy, and I'd say 90% of what I run into has some connection to trauma, either experienced trauma or brain trauma. And it's altered either the altered the structure of the brain or the person alters their perception of, hey, when something bad happens to you, it changes how you see yourself. It changes how you see the world. It changes how you see your past. It changes how you see your future. And so we end up with these roadmaps for our lives that aren't accurate. I call them implicit beliefs or implicit meanings. And then the other part was that, counseling, because these things are phenomenological, you can say, hey, this happened to this person, I can predict this. There's an adverse childhood experiences scale. And you can look at that and say, if this person has had more than three of these before age of 18, I can predict some things about their behavior. Reading the book Adult Children of Alcoholics, if you are an adult child of someone who is a severe alcoholic, I can make some predictions about how you interpret the world. So all of a sudden, there's science behind this. These things are predictable. There's patterns to them. And so when you understand that there's a pattern to something, you want to go to somebody who understands patterns. If I had to have my transmission replaced today, it would be a life-altering experience for me. The guy at the transmission shop does six a week. you go to a counselor, and this is the first time you've ever had grief, or the first time you've ever had intrusive thoughts, or the first time you've ever been depressed. It's a life altering for you. This guy sees it every day, and there's no mystery to it. It's not something wrong with your character. It's not something wrong with your fortitude as a man. It's something wrong with your transmission, and here's how to fix it.
Really beautifully put, and I really want to go back to that idea of trauma. What are some traumas that you see, or that maybe even people don't recognize as trauma? Because I didn't recognize some things in my past were trauma, you know, things that I was grieving deeply on, and I just thought they were something I should just, you know, man up and get over. So, like, what are some ideas of trauma, you know, just from obviously the obvious ones to, you know, even over the years, some of the things that have been trauma that a lot of people might not see as trauma.
So we often talk about big T versus little T trauma.
Okay.
Okay. So sometimes it's little T trauma, sometimes it's big T trauma, but it really depends on what value you gave it and then how long you've walked with that belief that the trauma created. Before we started the podcast, we were talking about rifles. Mm-hmm. Well, on a minute of angle, if I'm looking at a compass and I'm off 1 degree, so I'm trying to walk from here to Walmart and my compass is off 1 degree, that 1 degree doesn't matter in 100 steps. What happens if I walk that vector for 17,000 steps? The further away you go, the wider that angle gets. The longer you walk through life on a bad azimuth, this thing happened to me and it means this. The longer that meaning is skewed, the further away you get off healthy. And so people who experience trauma, number one, is when life doesn't turn out like I expect it to, I suffer loss. And humans grieve all losses. I thought I was going to be a Division I athlete, but I blew my knee. I thought I was going to go to Harvard on this scholarship, and for whatever reason, you know, I ended up going to a junior college. Any of those things that are expectation and reality don't meet have the chance of being traumatic. And it, like you say, it doesn't have to be life-altering like a blown-out knee. It could just be, I thought I was going to live in the dorm, I end up in an apartment. Hmm. And so anytime life doesn't turn out like I expect it to, it has the potential to be traumatic because, oh, I didn't get to do this, I'm a loser. This happened to me, I'm inferior. And we have those implicit beliefs, and those implicit beliefs cause us to react to life for a long, long time. And the longer you walk that path, the further away from healthy you get if those beliefs that we adopt or adapt are not healthy.
It's a really cool idea, that vector idea, because it makes perfect sense hearing you say that. And so, like, how often would you say, or I say, should say, when you first see a patient, like, how often have they taken more than a year, I would say? Have they been dealing with this sadness, this grief, this trauma for more than a year on their own? And they're just getting off this path, and they finally just kind of hit rock bottom. You find most people, they don't come to you, you know, with even probably a month or two of that initial trauma.
If it's grief, traditional grief, I'll see them within the first 6 months.
Interesting. Okay.
But I've met people who, when you begin to talk about their story, you know, they come in and they want to know what's wrong with me. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask the question, what happened to you? And when you understand that, there's people who've been walking around like this for 30 years, for 10 years, for 15 years, because they've had something happen that to them was life-altering. And it may not be life-altering to us, mm-hmm. but we don't get to pick what's traumatic for somebody else. But when I see a lot of people who have no idea that, oh, this behavior is connected to this behavior because I've got this implicit belief. An implicit belief is something that I know to be true, but I have no facts for it. Mm. Implicitly, everybody believes spiders are creepy.
Yes.
Really? What color are they? Oh, they're ugly. Look up spiders and you'll find they're every color of the rainbow. And without the idea that he's venomous, they're really not that creepy. But we have this idea that they are. We wouldn't touch a spider. We eat crab legs all day. What's the difference in a crab and a spider other than the one lives in the water and one makes webs?
Yeah, and you're exactly right. And so thinking about now that CBT training, where CBT, correct me if I'm wrong, is just you believe that you can change your thoughts, or you believe thoughts, I should say, cause the way you feel. And since you can change the way you think, you can change the way you feel through the cognitive behavioral therapy.
Absolutely. It's feelings and thoughts and emotions or behaviors or make this triad, and it works in either direction. It works counterclockwise or clockwise. So my thoughts affect my behaviors that affect my emotions. My emotions affect my behaviors that affect my thoughts. And they're almost inseparable. And I usually ask, what happened? What does it mean to you? And then does it mean what you think it means? Because if we assign valid meanings to things, we end up with healthy emotional expressions. If we assign invalid meanings to things, we end up with invalid emotional expressions. So when you experience emotions, number one, emotions are information. They're not always instruction. So our emotions don't tell us to do anything. They tell us something. And then number two, if my emotions lead me to balance and harmony, they're doing what they're supposed to do. If they lead to distress, destruction, or dysfunction, our emotions aren't working like they're designed to work.
And when you first see a patient, kind of take people through the process of like what you go through, or what the steps you take to kind of diagnose them or to help them. So you started off by just saying you want to know what happened to them. So you're trying to get a history, correct?
Yeah. Basically, I want to find out who they are, where they come from, what they like, what they don't like. And that gives you a little bit of a backdrop on them. And then, you know, I essentially say, okay, so you obviously, you know, nobody comes to the mechanic while their car's running well. So nobody comes to me on their best day. So what prompted you to call me? And they'll say, well, I'm having difficulty in this area. The first thing I look at is I define a problem as a lack of resources. And I think that's a great definition for a problem. If somebody comes in and they say, this is where I'm at, this is where I want to be. Well, what's missing to get there? Do you need a bridge? Do you need a rope? Do you need a boat? You know, what's missing? So I start looking at what are the resources. Some people just need education. Some people just need normalcy. They realize what I'm feeling is normal. This person did this to me and I'm angry. Well, if you weren't angry, you'd be a sociopath, you know. And so find out where they're at, and I try to see what's missing. And then based on is it maturity, is it resources, is it education, is it brain chemistry, is it medicine, whatever, then if I can find out what I think's missing, we plug in the missing resource. If it's not that simple and it's not just a matter of, oh, I've seen this before and this is what you're not doing, then I start looking at why are you processing information the way you are, and is it running through a trauma filter? Is there this implicit belief that something's broken in me? And so the brain is designed to protect you. You know, your brain, you know, the first time you get your capsule popped on your elbow in an arm bar, the next time you feel that similar sensation, you're quick to tap. Why? Because your brain says, hey, we know how this worked out last time. And so everything that is similar gets processed the same by the protective part of my brain. So I get stung by a hornet, I'll dodge a housefly. A dog bit me when I was, you know, 17. If it was a Doberman, I'll be scared of a Jack Russell. And so when we get into these positions, I can't get along at work. And every time my boss corrects me, I just fly off the handle. It just makes me so mad. I want to know, are you really mad at your boss? Or are you really mad at your stepdad? I want to know, are you really mad at your boss that you don't trust? Or were you traumatized by somebody who betrayed you in a relationship, and that lack of trust is ringing a bell from the past? And so if I can find that, hey, there's a theme running through this person's life, and I've got these events that are similar, same moments, I want to explore those with that person.
And so after you've done that and you start to use some of those CBT techniques, like what CBT techniques have you found most effective, or which ones do you really, because I mean, I know CBT has, I think it started, in the 60s or 70s is when it really started, and obviously it's developed tremendously since then.
I do essentially two things. I do what I call it fact-feeling integration. Okay. You know, what do you feel? What do you know? You know, make a list of your feelings. Now make a list of the facts you have to support those feelings. And you'll find out that as you talk about what you feel, implicit beliefs, versus what you know, factual beliefs, you'll start looking at what we call cognitive distortions. Am I trying to be responsible for something I don't control? Am I guilty of all or nothing thinking? Do I have this belief that if I'm a nice guy, you'll be a nice guy? Well, if I do, then when you're not a nice guy, it's my fault. And so I start looking at, are there cognitive distortions present, fact versus feeling integration? And then my favorite tool is to do what I call the event, meaning, emotion paradigm. You know, tell me what happened. What are the emotions? Are the emotions producing balance and harmony? Or are they producing distress, destruction, or dysfunction? If I see distress, destruction, and dysfunction, then I worry less about the event and worry less about the emotion. And I say, well, tell me about your perception filter. What does this mean to you? And when you attack those perceptions, that's where the cognitive behavioral therapy comes in. You change the meanings that these events have to you. You change the way you respond to them, and it corrects your compass.
And so, for instance, if I came to you and I said, just as an athlete, because I've come to you a couple times as an athlete, and you've helped me out tremendously, especially dealing with pressure, especially as I ascended the rankings of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, you know, and I put all this pressure on myself to always win. And so if I came to you and was just saying, hey, every time like I get tapped, if I get beat, I feel like a loser. You know, I feel like I'm letting people down. How would you help me change the way that I think about that?
Okay. So what does losing represent to you? Is it connected to something in the past? Did I blow the state championship in basketball and my girlfriend break up with me? You know, is there some kind of thing connected to that? And we'd explore that, or just simply, what does losing mean to you? Does losing a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu match make you a loser? And so this is what you feel. Is it true?
And I know one thing that really helped me was just kind of, losing one match doesn't define my whole career. It doesn't define the tens of thousands of roles that I've had, you know, but I've micro-focused on that loss. And I started just, again, labeling myself as like, I'm no good. I'm a loser. I don't deserve this belt, or I don't deserve, you know, feeling good about my, you're even being proud of how far I've come in jiu-jitsu. And I know a lot of guys experience that. A lot of guys, especially when they get a new belt promotion. You know.
Well, that's why we call them cognitive distortions, because the way we're wired makes us who we are. If you didn't feel that way about losing, you wouldn't have a black belt in the first place because you're a conscientious person and you strive for excellence. Yeah. I've been at the gym at noon on Tuesdays when it's not your roll day, but it's your workout day. And I've seen how you and Lindsay punish each other and the stuff that you guys do. And so if you didn't worry about it, you wouldn't be an exceptional athlete. But the same, it's kind of like the force, light side versus the dark side. You can get sucked into the dark side and make that my identity as opposed to my ethic. And just learning to balance that. Okay, how many times has focusing what you did wrong and beating yourself up caused you to ascend and be a better person?
It has, yeah.
Okay, so there's a function to that. At what point does it become maladaptive? Because if I only focus on the bad and don't focus on the good, what did I learn from this? Did this open up a weakness in me? And sometimes we don't find those weaknesses rolling in real time. You don't find those weaknesses till you show up on a mat with somebody you don't roll with every week. And that's when you go, oh, there's a hole in my game. And so understanding that, hey, losing is part of the game, because if you couldn't lose, what value is there to it? You know, I don't like Superman as a hero because he can't be killed. You know, if I'm invulnerable, I'm not very brave. I'm just bored looking for stuff to do. And my big issue, you know, early on in my comic days was, you know, you show up with kryptonite and Superman leaves, as opposed to Spider-Man or Indiana Jones, who get out there and do it every day. And they can get killed. And so when you recognize I can get beat, now am I going to let beating define me or refine me? And it's that balance. And a cognitive distortion that leans into the dark side then is I'm always a loser. I always lose. I always will lose. Now it's defined my past and it's defined my future. Is that true?
And so when you are working with, again, like using that example, because again, I think it's a great example for probably anybody listening, because you're going to go through that point in some point in your Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu journey where, you know, you put a lot of pressure on yourself, or at least most guys do. And so when you're trying to change that, as you said, you know, you're recognizing that you do, your thoughts are distorted, you have some cognitive distortions. But do you need to kind of examine your past and see? Because, like, for myself, you know, we talked about my soccer career. I didn't realize that, you know, when I first came to you 5, 6 years ago, when I was a brand new brown belt, that, yeah, man, I had some soccer trauma, just a little bit, you know, that was affecting the way I was perceiving Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, I think that most of what we currently deal with has some echoes from the past. Now, this is not a psychoanalytic approach, you know, where, you know, I was 4 and I didn't get a puppy, you know, something like that. But I do believe that we process information to protect ourselves and that we have these, this means this. And that the trauma you had with soccer was it had the potential to define you. And so those echoes of those feelings come in and go, oh, this is bad because I believe this is what this says about me. And you challenge not the validity, you challenge the validity of what it says or the strength of what it says. It may be valid, but it doesn't mean all that. Does that make sense? Okay.
Definitely. And thinking about self-esteem now, you know, because a lot of guys, and it's funny, you know, you see some of the strongest guys, guys that you perceive to be the strongest guys, you know, whether they're professional athletes or, you know, celebrities, and you realize a lot of them really suffer with low self-esteem. So how do somebody get like a more healthy look at themselves and really develop positive self-esteem? And just kind of talk about self-esteem. I didn't understand self-esteem for a long time. Like, I just thought self-esteem meant like I was, you know, confident and like myself, you know.
So self-image is how you see yourself. Self-esteem is how you feel about what you see. And so self-esteem basically comes from confidence. Confidence comes from competence. And a lot of times we think that competence equals mastery. And I believe in excellence, okay? But I'm not a very competitive person. I believe in being competent. And once you have the competence to do something, then you can be comfortable with it. So then you look at, here's a person who's really, really gifted at something and he's really, really talented. It boils down as a function of humility. Now I'm a nerd. I studied Greek in college because I have a Bible degree. You can't get a Bible degree from Harding University unless you can pass Greek, okay? And this is Koine Greek. It's a dead language. It's what the New Testament was written in. And the concept that I understand about the idea of humility is the absolute absence of self-consciousness. And what that means is I'm comfortable with who I am and comfortable with who I'm not. Not that I don't want to improve, not that I can't recognize holes in my game, not that I can't recognize attitudes that need, but it's I don't spend a whole lot of time beating myself up because I'm not as big as that guy or as young as that guy or as fast as that guy. You know, I like to illustrate it talking about big cats. A mountain lion probably doesn't really know he's a mountain lion. He knows he's not a deer. He doesn't care that he's not a bear. He's just walking through the woods. I'll eat that, and that's not going to eat me. And they do what they do without any self-consciousness. I can jump 18 feet in a tree from a sitting position if I'm a mountain lion. I can jump 23 vertical, horizontal feet if I, and it's not like they practice it. That's just what they are. So when you put in the time and the discipline and your art, whatever it is, and it's transformative, and you reach the level of competence, then you're confident, and that's where self-esteem comes from. It's you hear Lindsay talk about the way she used to walk around versus how she walked around when she started training. That at ease with yourself. And in that, I'm not comparing myself to other people. I'm comfortable with who I am. Put your hands on me, your first lesson's free. You know, that kind of stuff.
And so now thinking about the self-value, how we interpret our results a lot of times, especially athletes, as defining moments of who we are, because that was my big problem as a brown belt, especially. I mean, I was making myself miserable in training because I felt like if my results ever waned, or if, you know, I tapped this guy 5 times, the next session I tapped him 3 times, it was like, oh my gosh, I'm getting worse. Or, you know, like, no, I need to get more, better, better. And the results need to keep getting better. How do you separate, you know, your self-value from, you know, results in your field, you know, whether it is Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or just work?
Okay. I think it's from the book, The Talent Code.
Okay.
It talks about performance-based coaching versus outcome-based coaching. If outcome-based coaching says we're only successful when we win the ring, the belt, the trophy, then only one person is ever successful in a tournament. Okay, second place is first place loser, you know. Or what was my performance? You know, how well did I do cardio? How well did I do with my technique? How well did I do with my movement? How well did I do recovering from a bad position? Did I not panic when I got swept? All those things that you can measure, not objectively with here's a belt, here's a ring, here's a trophy, but what did I see myself do differently on the things that I can control on the inside? Because ultimately losing at anything, there is a function of some things that you can't control. Just plain and simple. You know, as an athlete, I'm getting older. Well, most of the guys that I roll around with are half my age and twice my size. Well, it's a tough world out there. And so I can't control what you bring to the table. I can only control what I bring to the table. And so learning to say, am I looking at this from performance base or outcome base? Now, I do believe that when you put in the process, you eventually end up with the product. But we only measure ourselves on product rather than process.
And so switching just a little bit to anxiety now. What is anxiety, and like, how do you help your patients deal with anxiety?
Anxiety is your body's response to stress. Whether it's a normal, you know, stress, I've got to go to work today and deal with the traffic on the parkway, or I'm going into competition. Nervous and excited are physiologically the same thing. It's just the label we give them. So when we experience anxiety, it's a physiological change. Your heart rate increases, your breathing changes, you get this hormone cocktail that's dumped into your system. You get a tightening of your muscles, your hands sweat, or your hands get cold, or whatever. Most people focus on the physiological component of that and they say, I don't like it. I've got this roiling in my stomach, the butterflies. That's adrenaline, and adrenaline makes you sick if you don't absorb it. You know, I've never been in a real fight that I didn't throw up afterwards, just for whatever, you know. And so when your body experiences that, the first question you ask is my body working properly? And the answer to that is absolutely. When you are called upon your body has called upon to do something, whether it's fight or flee, it used to be just fight or flee. Now it's fight, flight, or freeze. And we found out everybody freezes. Everybody freezes. Some people freeze for a nanosecond. Some people freeze for a long, long time. So everybody freezes. But if I'm going to run or if I'm going to fight, I have to be alert, motivated, and strong. How does your body make you alert, motivated, and strong? Hormone cocktail, increased respiration, increased heart rate, and increased muscle tension, increased, you know, all those physiological changes. When I'm called upon to perform and my body goes, It's go time, and it starts pumping, I've got to go, oh, man, that's cool. I'm ready. Versus, oh, I don't like this. I feel sick. I feel stressed. I feel nervous. And so once you start controlling your breathing, and I heard you and Stephen talk about the breath work. Well, we don't breathe properly under stress unless we practice it, because we tend to shallow breathe. Versus that big, deep, I call it 4 in, 8 out, where you totally empty your lungs. Well, once you let your body's natural mechanisms for making you alert, motivated, and strong do what they're supposed to do, performance anxiety should go away, because you should say, hey, my body's responding to these demands. Why do you yawn?
Tired.
No, your body needs more oxygen. And so when you're getting ready to go into a sleep cycle, your body says, let's take in a lot of oxygen so that when we go to bed and our lungs slow down, our brain has plenty of oxygen stored up. But nobody ever panics when they yawn. Oh, no, I can't breathe. Ah, it's terrible. It's a natural thing when your body says, hey, we're going to strip a little oxygen here so we can go take a nap. Well, the same thing when my body says, I need a shot of adrenaline. My heart rate needs to beat faster. My lungs need to breathe deeper because I'm about to fight this guy. Or I'm about to climb this thing. Or I'm about to kick in this door. Your body's just getting you ready for that. And then learning to be comfortable with it. You know, I think it's probably Chinese or Japanese, but, you know, do not seek silence. Learn to be at peace with the noise. And so when my body starts doing this, I recognize mentally I've understood I'm about to place demands on myself. My body's responded to that with, okay, this is the gear we shift into when we place demands on ourselves.
And so you just mentioned something, kicking in doors, because we have to talk about your work with the Huntsville Police Department. So 5 years, you get your counseling degree. After a couple of years, you start to work in your own private practice, correct? And then, well, I should say, when did you start working with the Huntsville Police Department? How long have you done it? And, you know, like, what do you do with those guys?
Oh, wow, that's a long story. I moved here in the spring of 86, and I was 22 years old, and I had a student in my youth group whose dad was a police captain. In December of 86, there was a guy took over a restaurant, an overland truck driver, high on all kind of stuff, came in, took over this restaurant, ran everybody out, and there's a lockdown. And so the SWAT team, back then was known as the SR team, Special Response Team. They get called out to this restaurant and shut down University Drive for 10 hours. Well, there's pressure. You got to get University Drive rolling. The city's frozen because of this. So outside of the SWAT team back in the day, somebody who's not a SWAT team guy made a call and says, you got to make entry on this building. We got a guy in there. He's high. The only thing in the building is bacon, eggs, and flour, and probably no reason to go in the building. But when these guys enter the building, he shoots a police officer, takes him down. I think he made a hip shot. The officer had enough presence of mind that he's emptying his shotgun, stroking the slide on a Remington 870 so the gun won't have any bullets for the bad guy to get. Well, the bad guy shoots him through his gas mask with a 357, and there's this lockdown. This police captain, once these guys, and we had two guys that went in and got this officer out. They made entry through the front lobby and essentially rescued this dude. Well, I'm sitting around and my phone rings and this police captain says, hey, Lonnie, I've got a SWAT cop in the hospital. And this is, we never dealt with anything like this. Would you go minister to that family? So as a 22 or 23-year-old kid, I insert myself into this thing and visit with his family. I met one member of the SWAT team. Everybody else is sequestered. You know, we don't do this stuff anymore. We, you know, you have one full sleep cycle before you do a debrief after an altercation like this. But in those days, these guys, and I remember them talking to me about it later, that, you know, hey, we spent, you know, 2 hours in this room. We still had blood on our boots, you know. But I go minister to these folks. And that's what a local minister did in a small town of Salem, Arkansas. Anything that happened, you went to the hospital. So it wasn't that strange for me. And that's 86. In 92, when I got my degree, this same police captain, Mac McCutcheon, who's now a representative in Montgomery, came to my office and said, hey, we think we'd like to start a volunteer chaplains program. And we're recruiting guys to just volunteer to go through a little bit of training, ride with our officers every now and then. And so I got recruited to be a chaplain as a volunteer in the spring of 1992. Early on, we realized, hey, there's 10 of you guys. You're going on call every 10 weeks. That's not how you build relationships. You know, it's kind of representative of my jiu-jitsu. You can't go to the gym once every 10 weeks and do very well. So they ask us to pick a unit, you know, first shift Baker side, second shift Charlie side, that kind of fit our schedule and just spend extra time with them. And I looked on the list, and the canine were taken, and the ladies at the crossing guards were taken. So I said, "What's SR?" And they said, "They're yours." And I got assigned to be the dedicated chaplain that interfaced with these guys. So I go down there the first night. I'm driving a Isuzu Amigo. I'm wearing a button-down shirt, khaki pants, and some Rockports. And I get out of the truck, and their sergeant says, "Hey, boys, this here's the new chaplain what's been sitting down here to straighten us out." And a guy, they're getting ready to PT. And a guy says, "You're going to run with us, Reverend?" And, I'm a dumpy little guy. I hadn't done any athletics in high school. I was a rock climber and wrestled some. But, I took my shirt off and ran with those guys in a pair of khaki pants and a pair of Rockports. And I made a mile and a half before they broke my pace. And instead of leaving me, two guys came back and got me, said, "Hey, we don't leave anybody behind." And from there, they invited me to eat supper. I said, "Well, I'm really supposed to go home," and told my wife, "I was just going to meet you guys." And they said, "We'll come back next week and plan to stay for supper." And the next week, it was plan to stay for supper and get in the stick and let's walk into some buildings together. And then it was like, "What if you hide in the building and see if you can detect us coming in?" And I thought, put me in a building and come get me? There's no way. Well, I didn't understand tactics, and it was unbelievable what those guys can do with flashlights, hide their movement, master movement. So I began just to hang out with these guys, train with them, 6 p.m. to 2 a.m. We would run and we would train. And in those days, there were 11 guys on the team, and SR1, that's the sergeant, and then your seniority is SR2, 3, 4, And every week, the 10th week, SR10 did the training. So the four snipers always did outdoor programs. We'd always do a woods problem, and the entry guys would always do inside problems. And somewhere near the end of that summer, they said, "Well, this is the 12th week. Would you they and they knew I had a hobby, did some adventure-based therapy. Would you go rappelling with us? Would you show us how modern rappelling versus they were trained by a Vietnam era Green Beret," which means you're expendable, by the way. And so we went rappelling up on Green Mountain with some pretty modern equipment, some modern ropes, and I kind of fell into the role in of being the rope guy with the SWAT team. And in August of that year, they got called out, and the youngest guy on the team ended up having to kill a guy. He had a got into a gun confrontation, and there was a chaplain on call, but they wouldn't talk to him. They said, "We have a chaplain. We don't talk to anybody but Lolly." And so a captain came and got me. They found out I was at a wedding, and Captain Nixon came over and got me at this wedding, and we drove to Sonic on South Parkway with this young cop, and I stayed with him till probably 3 in the morning, debriefing the shooting. And the chief then at that time said, "If I bought you a pager and put you on it, would you go when it goes off?" And I said, "If I'm in town," and it got to just be I was an allowed presence with the SWAT team. And you fast forward that to 28 years later, and every new guy that gets on the team, I'm just an accepted part of the team. I'm not a shooter, I'm not an operator. But I'm participating in their training. So if they're learning to clear a building, I'm the guy who hides in it. Well, I hide in these buildings all the time. I know every nook and cranny. And I'm a climber, so I can get up into stuff. And so I start learning and become a reverse engineer in building clearing. So I couldn't teach you how to clear this building, but I show you where you get killed in this building. So now I get to say, "This is your danger areas in this building." So I get to do this with SWAT every week. I'm playing hide and go seek. I'm their bad guy. And then I get to do some of it at the academy. And then SWAT teaches a week out of every academy. I get to go hang out with the young cadets and do building clearing and felony vehicle stops. And we did some weapon retention stuff. So a little bit of my interest in grappling got to start being applied with that. And it's just been an expanding role so that, the chief sent me to hostage negotiation training, so I've been to the FBI basic training with that. And I'm just this resource person. Think of me as a over-glorified mascot. And I'm just this guy who's not a cop, who hangs out with cops. And I teach at the academy. I teach stress management at the academy. I teach mental health awareness at the academy. The cadets come to the ropes course and spend about 4 hours with me doing leadership and team building work at the academy. I teach in the CIT program, which is crisis intervention training, which is basically principles of de-escalation and how police officers respond to people in an altered mental state. So I get to do a 40-hour certification class for our CIT officers, the program Johnny Hollingsworth invented. And I've just got this open door kind of thing that I do with the cops. But most of my time is spent running around with SWAT guys.
Very, very cool. I mean,
I'm sorry that took so long.
No.
It's a 28-year compacted into, you know, a podcast.
No, that's very cool. And so, first, what have you learned, I guess, working with the cops? Like, how has that changed you, and especially your perception of cops? You know,
The cool thing is that cops are people. You know, you see a bunch of guys, and you know, they always wear a special style pants. And it used to be camouflage pants and black t-shirts. Now it's multi-cam pants and green t-shirts. That's our training uniform. And, you know, 11 dudes walk into a restaurant dressed like this with drop leg holsters, and it's like the scene in The Last Samurai when the samurai ride into town. And everybody in the restaurant looks, well, they're talking about, hey, my kid's got a baseball game tonight after training. Can I leave early, Sarge? Or my wife is mad at me because of this. And they're walking this restaurant, and you think, the SWAT team is here. And they're dudes. Family devoted, love their wives, love their children, and they love your children, they love your wives, because they put themselves in harm's way to take care of other people. And it's not a power trip, and these guys have a desire to serve and protect. Now, everybody has bad cops. There's bad jiu-jitsu gym owners. But in Huntsville, Alabama, what I've learned is to be a police officer in Huntsville, Alabama is a calling. And these guys, I think, are as well-trained as anybody. And so that's what I've learned about cops. The other thing is I learned a lot about trust, a lot about faith. You know, you train a new SWAT guy, and I hope this doesn't sound terrible. You can teach a monkey to shoot a machine gun. You know, you put it center mass, you look down the barrel with both eyes, you squeeze the trigger, and don't fight it. It'll draw a circle. You know, we can teach you to shoot. We can teach you to rappel. We can make you run till you throw up. When they choose a new guy for the team and he's gone through the PT and we've evaluated him, he's done all this stuff, at some point, one of the older operators will go, well, the bottom line is, will you go through a door with him? Now, when you go through a door with somebody, we call it throwing a block. He is protecting the side of the room you can't see. And you're protecting the side of the room he can't see. And when you go in there, you're hoping to catch the bullet that came towards your friend. And the bottom line behind that question is, will you go through a door with him? Is, are you selfish or are you selfless? And the function of selfishness and trust is an inverse proportion. If I think you are selfish, I don't trust you. And if I think you're not selfish, I do trust you. And I learned a lot about not being selfish and trusting people, mm-hmm. working with these dudes. Because literally, when they go into a situation, two cops out here on patrol, when they approach a car, their job is to be selfless and protect each other and then protect the citizens. In this narrative of the nationwide, power-hungry, abusive cop is just a false narrative. 273 million encounters with police officers in 2019, and 1,600 people were killed. And of that, you know, you're looking at, they had deadly force, you know. And so your chances, you know, of being killed by a cop in a violent confrontation is 0.0004% or something like that. I mean, it's crazy. And this narrative that cops are just out here, you know, knuckle-dragging, bootjack thugs, just not true. Now, are they out there? Yeah. Well, there's abusive football coaches, too. But the police officers in America, and especially in Huntsville, Alabama, in America, are well-trained and are not what the media has portrayed them to be. And I jumped all over a soapbox. I'm sorry.
No.
I stopped podcasting and went to preaching.
and that's very, very well said. Very, very well said, Lonnie. And so kind of moving from there now, let's get a little bit into your grappling experience. And so you're the guy that, I mean, you showed Brandon his first submission. So a lot of people, you might not know that, but Lonnie Jones, when Brandon was a kid at a youth camp.
And they tried to throw me in the lake.
Brandon would try and sneak attack and take Lonnie down, you know, him and a group of cronies. And Lonnie would have to, you know, put some moves on him. So, you know, kind of talk about that. Like, when did you first start learning submissions and how is your love for grappling? You know, I mean, you've been grappling for 30 plus years.
My grandfather would get up on the roof and turn the antenna so we could watch Georgia Championship Wrestling. And so we started watching, you know, just the good old wrestling stuff. And I was fascinated by the techniques of controlling limbs. And so, you know, even as a young kid, when I would play wrestle, I wasn't jumping off the top rope, hitting anybody with my elbows. I was doing a figure four or doing a cobra, which is kind of a half Nelson mm-hmm. gift wrap move that it used to be called the cobra. I think you guys call it the gift wrap now. Yeah. So I started goofing around with that. And then realized that as short as my arms are and as uncoordinated as I am, I'm not going to stand and throw punches with anybody. So when people would pick on me in school, I'd wrap them up. Just hold them down until they blew their steam out. And just kind of develop this, I guess, for lack of a better word, catch wrestling style of, you know, my own how to survive. I was 4'11" tall in the 8th grade. And our 8th grade was part of the high school. So I'm on the bottom of the food chain. I am finding Nemo, and there's sharks in this place. And you know, it was always, let's initiate freshmen, you know, and they throw you in. And we weren't really freshmen. Freshmen are not until ninth grade. So I just kind of got comfortable using grappling, you know, to handle a guy. And started playing around with some of that. And then we had a PE coach that wanted us to be well-rounded athletes. And so he'd take 6 weeks and teach tumbling. He'd take 6 weeks and teach fundamentals of tennis. He'd take 6 weeks and we would, it wasn't your typical PE program. Here's a ball, you boys go play. We learned the ins and outs of every sport. And I wasn't a high school athlete. I worked, you know, and climbed. And I didn't, my family couldn't afford for me to play athletics. And I really wasn't interested because if I wanted anything like a car, I needed to buy it. And so my athleticism, quote-unquote athleticism, came from this PE class. Well, I think it was my junior year, he brings this guy in to teach 6 weeks of self-defense. He's a former alumni from Oxford High School. That's where I grew up. And he was in the FBI. And we did knife takeaways, pistol defense, you know, getting out of a chokehold. And it spoke to me like nothing else spoke to me. Then I became a self-defense enthusiast. And so, you know, just start studying books on that and wrestling and goofing around. And in college, would run into guys who had degrees or ranks from your traditional kata-based martial arts stuff and really wouldn't have any real issue dealing with them. And most of it was friendly roughhousing in a dorm, the vinegar contest. But it was like, what I'm doing here as an untrained or self-trained person really, really works. And I goofed around a little bit of Aikido, tried some striking stuff in a Chinese Kempo class. The guy who was the bodyguard for the rock band Crocus lived in Mountain Home, Arkansas. And, you know, he wore these Olympic-style gi pants, never had a shirt on, and had a rat tail, you know. And named Galen Gifford, I believe, was his name. He had a little karate school. So I tried to go learn some striking stuff. And he would, you know, any kick thrown above the waist is a wasted kick in his style. You break a knee, you break a hip, you know. So it was pretty down and dirty stuff. And I played around with that and goofed around with some Aikido stuff. And that was, you know, kind of my, if you put your hands on me, I can get your hands off me. And if I can't get away from you, I can make you want to get away from me. And so just pretty brutal, you know, self-taught roughhouse stuff. And one of the kids in my youth group, John Jenkins, John still lives in town, I think he's an engineer here, worked out at Triad. He showed up at my house one Sunday afternoon after he'd graduated. We used to all go to my house and wrestle in the backyard and, you know, do this crazy stuff. We would take a rope, a 4.5 foot piece of rope, and you'd grab it, I'd grab it, and the guy who let go of it first lost. and there were no rules. You just get out there and see if you can take the rope away from a guy. Or we'd put a circle of rope down, and one guy would stand in the middle, and the guys on the outside would spin 15 times and come in and try to tackle you where they're off balance. And you learn to deal with multiple opponents and self-made up stuff. Well, John shows up at the door and says, "Hey, Lonnie, do you still wrestle?" Yeah, I still wrestle, John. He said, "I've been in a class for 2 months, and I want to try it on you." So I walk out in the backyard with this kid I've cleaned my yard up dozens of times with. And he had a black belt in Tong Soo Do. But if you get in close where he couldn't do that, you know, jumping sidekick, you could grab him, you know. He said, "Well, let's pretend we're in a fight, and you've knocked me down, and you got on top of me." So I'm sitting on top of this kid that I have literally sent him to church with grass stains on his forehead, and I begin to tap out. You know, it's tap or nap. He puts me in triangle chokes and arm triangles and Americanas and Kimuras. And for 2 hours, all I did was go, "I know nothing." And everything I thought I believed to be true in the universe had failed me. And I said, "What is this stuff, John?" And John says, it's Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And so I went and visited at Gold's Gym. They had a room with no mats. We're just wrestling on carpet. And I started kind of goofing around with that. And just when I could, I would go. And full-time youth ministry working, going to grad school. I didn't have a lot of time to go, but found some some VHS tapes with the Gracies. Eventually found Submissions 101 on the internet and just started kind of fooling around with Submissions 101. It's the first time I'd heard a tent plant. Mm-hmm. And regardless of how you feel about Mr. Bolden, he was the only girl at the prom. So, yeah. You know, and then in 2009, my large intestine ruptured. I was on a hunting trip and was in Anniston, Alabama. And I had this severe rupture, an 18-inch piece of my colon rotted from the inside out. And ended up wearing a bag for 21 weeks. Ended up having, 10 or 11 surgeries after that. But in either 09 or 10, Brandon had Eddie Bravo come to Webster's Karate in Decatur. And he called me up. And said, "Hey, Eddie Bravo is coming to town. Would you like to meet him and do a seminar?" So I show up in Decatur, Alabama, and I've got unhealed scars on my abdomen. And I'm going to go to this grappling thing. And I'm way overweight and just, but I'm trying to do something athletic to get my body back. Because I thought, hey, you've climbed your last tree. You've climbed your last rock. You pulled your last bow back. Because this... they gutted me like a deer. And I go to this seminar. I bring a kid from church named Cody Gothard, so I'll have a drilling partner who won't murder me. And, Chris, we get in there, and there's, 80 people there. And Eddie Bravo's there. I've never met Eddie Bravo and never heard of him, but I'm seeing this stuff. And there were three girls there. And I don't remember if they were Thai boxers or – but I told Cody, I said, "Look, if something goes south, with my abdomen, I pass out. Do I have to review who is and who is not allowed to give me mouth-to-mouth? Because this dude with mohawks and tattoos versus the three ladies in the room." I said, "We're on the same page here, right?" I said, "Other than that, let me go see Jesus. I don't need these guys reviving me." So I get reconnected with Brandon, and he'd been to stuff I'd spoken at, and I'd been to things that he'd done. And he was at a youth rally in Rome, Georgia, and had really been progressing in the tent plant system. And we got on the floor of a gym, and I realized, you put your hands on the wrong person. I knew then he was already better than I was. And I don't even know if he was a white belt, but he's training at Webster's. Mm-hmm. And I realized there's been a transformation in this young man. And I started kind of following his career. And so when he moved to Bender's and put out on Facebook he was going to start his own thing, I started training over there. And so I've been introduced to the Tent Planet system, and I'm Tent Planet for life. I'm a no-gi guy. My gi hangs in the closet. I don't ever put it on. And so that's kind of, where I'm at.
And what did it mean to get your purple belt? Because I know that was a big goal of yours. And again, man, you've got a lifelong grappler. And you mean so much to 10 Planet Decatur, first of all. You know, what did that purple belt mean to you, you know, when you got it last year?
Okay, so, you know, I've got a couple of dead deer heads hanging on my wall. I've got a trophy somewhere in here. I can't find it. I won a push-up contest in college.
Okay.
Well, the only two accolades I have for athleticism is my deer heads and a push-up trophy. That purple belt's and I don't tell everybody I'm a purple belt, but if I have to brag about something, that means more to me, second only to my SWAT pin, is what that purple belt means to me. Because when I first started working out, it was blue belts or guys who had the DVD series. If you saw a purple belt, it was like seeing Jesus walk on the water. Mm-hmm. We didn't know any ranked people. And, you know, I drive to Decatur and be in a room with you and Lindsay and Brandon, three black belts. I can get on the mat and roll with the, you know, John Bill's a brown belt, you know, and all of a sudden, so, you know, to be able to take something that started out as a self-taught hobby and stuff I practice in my garage with a 10x10 mat and a DVD and a VHS player to a legitimate instructor says, we're going to give you a purple belt. I cannot describe what that means to me. And it's not the product, but the process. Because the summer that I got it, you know, I'd been a blue belt for a little while, and I was given a blue belt. I wasn't promoted. You know, it was like, Lonnie, you're sloppy, you move bad, you know, you're strong as a gorilla on steroids. But if you entered a tournament as a white belt, it would not be fair. So we've got to do something here. The elephant's in the room. And so I felt like Brandon and Chris, it's a Chris Herzog seminar that they gave me. And I was blown away with that. I called John Jenkins that night. Almost couldn't talk. I've been given a blue belt, you know. But I was sitting in a hotel room in North Carolina and had typed out a text to Brandon. I need to know what I have to do to change my rank. And I went, that's stupid. That's putting pressure. You sound like some soccer mom who wants their kid to be the goalie. And I deleted it. And I opened up Facebook, and Brandon said, I'm going to be doing this online class. And if you'll sign up for this online class and turn in your stuff. And it was this little series that he did with the Google Classroom. And I started the first one in May. I was one of three people out of 11 who finished it. But he was, do this move, do these reps, do 200 reps a month. And for the first time since 09, I had a three-month run where I did not get injured and didn't have to have surgery, nothing going on. And I did everything he put out that summer and was getting to go train with you guys privately on Tuesdays, every Tuesday of that summer. And at the end of that summer, and Brandon says, hey, you've been missing class, and when's the next time you can be one of my classes? I said, well, you know, my schedule's killing me. And so, okay. And then Kaya called me and asked when I was going to be in class again. And then Brandon called and said, is there any way you come to my noon class today? I was like, no, but if you need something, I can be there by 1. He goes, come at 1 then. And I drove over there thinking I'm going to be on the podcast or something. And I wore some shorts in case I got to roll. And he does this promotion thing. And I was speechless, dude. It was unbelievable what that has meant to me.
Man, that makes me so happy. I love that.
And you gave me private lessons, and you would work with me on stuff. And you know, hey, you're letting your limbs get separated. I remember when you taught me connections. I don't even remember at the Bender's Gym. You said, whoever wins a battle of connections wins a fight. And it was my first introduction to real framing, but at the time you were calling them connections. And it was like, I wasn't doing anything with anybody in the gym, but anybody else put their hands on me, you know, and it became this. And then you guys have been so patient and worked so well with me and would give me advice. You just don't know what that means to me.
Man, Lonnie, I'm almost speechless. That's beautiful, man. So now moving into your book, okay?
Okay.
Only got like two or three more questions and then we'll wrap this thing up. I got to talk about your book, Grappling with Life, you know, Controlling the Inside Space. Why did you write it and how do you use grappling to, you know, kind of talk about how to deal with life?
Okay. So I wrote a couple of smaller books. I've got a youth ministry book out that was done years ago that a group said, hey, if you'll let us clean it up, we'll publish it for you, kind of through the Amazon Kindle thing. And then a guy named Dale Jenkins said, you need to be writing. If you're not writing, you need to be writing. So I wrote a book called Cognitive Spiritual Development. It's about spiritual self-esteem. I won't get into that. It's based on Carol Dweck's book, Mindset.
Okay.
And in her book, Mindset, well, I believe in Christianity there are people who have these mindsets. Not that I'm not good, but I can't ever be good enough. And I use some people out of the New Testament, a group of people called the Samaritans, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Gentile Christians as examples. Well, Dale Jenkins said, you know, if you wrote a book entitled it, Lonnie Jones Talks About Mental Health, rather than Cognitive Spiritual Development, it might sell better. And so I sit down to write this discussion, The Christian and Mental Illness. And the more I wrote about it, it felt like a textbook. And the more, it just didn't flow. And then I got to thinking, suppose I didn't write this for a Christian audience, but what if I could influence these young people that I know who are competitors? And, you know, I said, these guys look like they have all the self-confidence in the world, but you get a chance to talk with them, and they've got screwy relations with their girlfriends, or some of these guys self-medicate. And I, again, I think, could I put anything down in a really user-friendly format that would help grapplers deal with life? They don't need my instruction on grappling. They got Brandon and Scaff and Lindsay. But what a, and so I just thought, what's the biggest thing? What would they hammer into me? Control your inside space. Well, I began to use inside space as a metaphor for the real inside space, your heart, your soul, and your mind. And so I just looked at the important lessons that I at least believe to be true as a purple belt that you guys had taught me. And I said, can I take facts, what's true about jiu-jitsu, turn that into a concept, take it from jiu-jitsu and put it into real life, a conceptualization of the principle. Brandon's, if it's true at A, it's true at Z, that's what makes it true. And then can I make some applications? And can I come up with some principles? And it turned out I came up with 10 that I thought were fairly valid and really put it out precisely for the jiu-jitsu community, hoping it would be of benefit, because everybody doesn't have the ability to call me and come to my office and sit down and talk with me. And I was hoping to make a contribution to the jiu-jitsu community at large on, okay, you got your act together on the mat. Can I help you and give you some sage wisdom? And I'm 57. Some of those guys in that room are half my age. I got a pair of wrestling shoes that's 23 years old, you know. And so I it had been decently well received. And about the time I finished it, I was getting some calls about, would you come to our corporation? Would you come to our social workers who have to do house visits? And would you teach self-defense? And so I would take that little book and use the 10 principles as a self-defense seminar, but then say, and by the way, in case you're in a screwy relationship, in case you have some people who are toxic, in case you have some entanglements, and use it as a handout for a really lightweight self-defense seminar.
Very cool. I love that. And the book is incredible. You know, it's one of the books that I keep just around. I have like 5 or 6 books I like to just keep around, you know, just in case if I am having a bad day, if I am, you know, just pick it up. And it is just an excellent book. Where can people get that book?
It's on Amazon. You just get on Amazon and either type in Grappling with Life or type in Lonnie Jones, and the few little things that I've been involved in writing are on there. And or join the PGF and get a free copy. Become a competitor to the PGF, and I'll give you a free copy.
Hey, next season's 225 and under. So you guys that want, dealing with some issues in your life, just join the PGF. You can get those demons out on the mat, as well as get Lonnie's book to help you deal with them. But last question I have, and this is a topic, you know, and I was telling you beforehand that I'm super passionate about. It's just opening people's minds to therapy, you know, just making people feel more comfortable and feeling like, you know, oh, you know, the stigma behind going to a therapist, or like, you know, kind of accepting that you have, you know, some mental health issues or some brain health issues. But what would you tell to somebody that, you know, is contemplated going to a therapist? Like, you know, how do you deal with that stigma?
So I've been tasked to help develop a peer support program for the police department. And so there's a radio code in police work called a 1055. That radio chat, if you're not doing clear talk. Well, a 1055 basically means you're calling for another officer to help you. So if I get in a fight with a guy and I need a 1055, does that mean I'm a weakling?
No, no.
Okay. If I'm going to chase a guy, I can chase him with my car or my radio, or I can try to run him down. Am I a weakling if I use a car to catch a guy who's faster than me?
I know.
Okay. I've got a force multiplier on my belt. I can restrain you. I can spray you. I can use intermediate impact weapons. Am I a weakling if I use the tools available for me?
No.
So, you know, I drive nails with a hammer, not my hands. I change lug nuts on my car with a wrench, not my fingers. A therapist is a tool. And it is smart to ask somebody to look at a situation and get their perspective from it. You learn about grappling by having somebody else watch you grapple and say, from where I'm sitting, you can't see this where you're at. That's all a therapist does. And a therapist, I've gone through hundreds of hours of dealing with people in troubled marriages. This is the first time your marriage has been in trouble. I've gone through hundreds of experiences with people with grief. This is the first time you've lost a loved one. And so why not take somebody who has the resources and use that? And it's, you know, the first thing you ask your therapist is, who do you talk to? And if your therapist is not talking to somebody else, he doesn't believe in his product. Okay? And so I would advise you to think about, is there somebody that I can trust that gives me unconditional acceptance and gives me absolute privacy? Well, some of us are lucky enough we have friends like that. But some of us have things that we think, shame is the fear of loss of connections. Brené Brown, if I told you that, well, you come tell me that and I'm not eating supper with you. You come tell me that, I'm not going to be at your house at Christmas. You know, I'm an absolute, any therapist is an absolute, non-judgmental, safe place to go and work through some things from different angles. And it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with your character. You're not weak. You're using a tool. You know, would you do this on your own, or would you go train in a gym where there's a black belt? Well, everybody knows the benefit of training. Well, seeing a therapist is just like training your mind, training your heart, training your perspective. And I would highly recommend it, because not just that I'm in the business, but, you know, I know the value of it because there's people I talk to. I've got a fellow therapist named Ben Hayes. He worked under my license for 5 years as he got his license. He's one of the guys I talk to on a regular basis about, hey, I need your perspective on this. And so it's no different than having a coach at a gym. You're just getting kind of like a life coach or an emotion coach or a psychologist coach. And get rid of the stigma that real men don't ask for help. Real men ask for help.
Amen. And so, final thoughts. Anything you want to say to the people or anything, you know, anything?
Oh, man. I love the jiu-jitsu community. I love the 10th Planet family. I feel like, you know, just like I do with SWAT. I don't belong, but I'm welcome. And I go in anywhere, anytime. And I'm not as in shape as those guys. I'm not as young as those guys. I'm not as powerful as those guys. But I walk in the gym and it's like I'm part of the, and I get the same kind of acceptance with the cops. And I appreciate you guys letting me hang out with y'all and feel cool. And my life has been changed by my experiences with you guys, and I value this community, specifically you and Brandon and Lindsay. Love you guys.
Man, you know, you will always be a part of our family. You're a huge part of 10th Planet Decatur. I can't stress that enough. And we love you. Seriously, you've helped all of us so much. You know, me personally, and dude, I just I love you, man.
So, well, thanks for letting me be here. Love you too, man.
Yeah, I appreciate you jumping on the podcast, but let's end it. Guys, there's Lonnie Jones for you. He definitely will be on in the future again. I just love sitting down talking to him. I learned so much today. I hope you guys did too. You guys have a great day. Make sure you're tuning in every Friday night to the PGF. Love you guys. Peace.
Thank you. That was extremely enjoyable.